This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It's the start of October, and this week, the president has COVID. President Trump announced early Friday morning that he and his wife have tested positive for the novel coronavirus. Hours earlier, we learned that top presidential aide Hope Hicks had the virus. Hicks started to feel unwell at a campaign event in Minnesota on Wednesday, the Wall Street Journal reported. She isolated on the flight home and tested positive Thursday. Despite that information, President Trump, who had been in close contact with Hicks, traveled to Bedminster, New Jersey for a fundraiser with dozens of supporters with whom he had close contact. So contact tracing is now underway in New Jersey, as well as at the White House. And of course, on Tuesday, the president spent 90 minutes in a room with his opponent, Joe Biden, for a debate at which the president was, well, he was talking a lot in an indoor space. To talk about that, let's bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. As always, I'm your center. I'm joined by Michael Brendan Doherty, senior writer at National Review on the right, and on the left, Jamel Bowie, columnist at the New York Times. Hello.
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 We also have a special guest this week. Megan McArdle, columnist at the Washington Post, is joining us. Hello, Megan.
Hi.
So, Michael, the president has often been dismissive of certain measures to contain the spread of the virus. He's eagerly returned to in-person campaigning, often in crowds where people aren't wearing masks. He even made fun of Joe Biden at Tuesday's debate for wearing masks too much. Does the president bear moral responsibility for getting COVID and for exposing other people to it?
I have no idea. I don't think I could judge his actual culpability unless I was omniscient.
I mean more about prudence and responsibility here. I mean, the president, he went to this fundraiser on Thursday. Doesn't that show disregard for the safety even of his own close supporters? It seems that, you know, we can feel bad for the president and wish him a good recovery, which I certainly do. Apparently he's experiencing mild symptoms, so we don't know that he's even going to get seriously ill here. He may well not. But it seems like this was a foreseeable outcome of certain choices that he made, that as president of the United States, we should have expected him to make better choices.
I can't disagree with that. I would only say that there are other leaders in the world who have contracted coronavirus, and we don't know that they were taking unreasonable risks. And not everyone who has contracted coronavirus and developed COVID-19 took unreasonable risks. I don't know how he got it. I'm not defending him and his behavior. I don't think his behavior has been all that praiseworthy from the beginning of this crisis. But I just hesitate to step in and say that he is definitely responsible. You know, it could be someone close to him is responsible and didn't take a proper precaution. But again, he does set the tone from the top. So I don't think anyone could be contradicted by saying that he is in some way responsible.
Look, I mean, I wrote a book on failure, and one of the really interesting things you learn about failure is that many people take bad risks. But the thing is, he took so many risks, and we can't obviously say that maybe he would have gotten it anyway, right? But he took so many risks. I mean, let's start with his mishandling of the pandemic. He spent an enormous amount of time telling the United States that this was not a big deal and there was nothing, we didn't need to do a lot of testing, we didn't need to have quarantines. When his experts recommended quarantines, he tweeted out, liberate Virginia, and on and on and on. So for one thing, the background rate of COVID in the United States is likely significantly higher because of Donald Trump. Second of all, he used testing as a substitute for masking, for social distancing, and other things that could have prevented this case. So in that sense, he took an unnecessary and, to my mind, immoral risk. And the result of that is that his much higher risk of COVID, you know, may or may not actually have translated. But when you have those two things together, yes, I think he is morally culpable.
Jamel?
I don't disagree with Megan as far as moral culpability goes. It seems that President Trump did everything he could to signal how not seriously he took the pandemic and took the virus, scoffing at mask wearing, holding these massive rallies with thousands of people. And so, now that he's positive for COVID, it's hard to say that he doesn't bear responsibility for that outcome. I don't think anyone should be gleeful about it. It's quite bad that the leader of the country has a potentially deadly disease. But culpability is all his. He shouldn't have done this. He was behaving irresponsibly, and behaving irresponsibly in a way that surely influenced the behavior of millions of other people.
Even before this story broke on Friday, this was a remarkable week. Let's talk a little bit about that debate on Tuesday, which brought the president into a room with Joe Biden and Chris Wallace and about 80 supporters of each campaign. It was a hell of a debate. I actually, as a person who moderates discussions for a living, I really felt deeply for Chris Wallace. Moderating a train wreck is physically exhausting. It causes you to die inside a little bit, and it sometimes causes you to hate the panelists that you are working with. And Wallace was definitely in one of those situations. He increasingly had to scold and plead with the president to let Joe Biden answer questions. Weirdly, this seemed to undermine the president's goal of drawing attention to Biden's weak spots. Michael, what did you make of this debate? Did we learn anything from the debate?
I think we learned that the president has lost the ability to make a populist case for his reelection or for his presidency. He wasn't able to tie issues like, even when he brought them up, sometimes in a blunderbuss way, issues like Hunter Biden's financial dealings abroad. He wasn't able to tell a story about the kind of corruption that happens in Washington and why you would want an unconventional politician like he is still to be at the head of government. And I think you're right, Josh, that we saw in his attempt to dominate the proceedings, he did not let Joe Biden hang himself in some ways. I think Joe Biden potentially could have done more damage to himself as well if Trump didn't interrupt him. I mean, it was not a good look for Joe Biden to say at the front of the debate, I am the Democratic Party, then to say he, you know, doesn't want to take a position on court packing at all, and he wants to wait to hear from the people. If Donald Trump had let him be probed on those matters more, I think it would have hurt Joe Biden more. But instead, the president interrupted and probably made himself look like an uncontrolled id on the stage to a lot of people who don't normally tune into politics.
Jamel, I think Michael's point about the president's failing to seize on any sort of populism is really interesting and important in the context of this debate and in this broader campaign, where it looks like the president is much weaker in the upper Midwest than he was 4 years ago. Polls even showing Joe Biden often in the lead in Iowa, a state that the president won by 9 points. And the issues that the president gained so much ground on in those states, especially immigration and trade, have just completely fallen off the map in this campaign. And instead, you've had the president take certain stands, failing to get a COVID relief bill through, a second round of COVID relief, nominating a Supreme Court justice who I think is divisive in ways that the Republican Party did not quite anticipate, that don't seem to be playing with that constituency that he needed to win. And I didn't see any strategy in this debate aimed at them.
This was probably inevitable because Trump never really had any kind of firm policy views, any kind of vision, any kind of will to, I think, impose that vision or persuade congressional Republicans to go along. But now that it's happened, it becomes, you know, there's path dependency. So for the last 6 months or so, Democrats have been basically begging Trump to let them pass trillions of dollars in more aid for the economy. And if Trump actually wanted to go through with these populist instincts, he would have taken this deal. And if, you know, if the cost of the price, if the price of that deal for Democrats is Trump sending out, you know, little, you know, checks with his name on it, you know, branding the aid Trump bucks or whatever, I think they would have taken it. And he would probably be in a much stronger position for reelection, but he didn't take it. And in the same way during the debate, there are these opportunities for him to emphasize, you know, if not current policymaking, then at least the past 3 years of the, you know, growing economy, emphasizing laws like the First Step Act, you know, doing the kinds of things that at least would suggest a follow through on his 2016 appeal. And he, you know, sort of didn't do that either. I think, you know, my read of what happened on Tuesday was that he had a strategy of trying to interrupt Biden, of trying to throw Biden off of his game, and essentially got angry that it wasn't working. And as he got angrier that it wasn't working, he became less and less coherent. to the extent that he was coherent to begin with.
I want to hear from both Megan and Michael about that failure to deliver another round of coronavirus aid. This is something that has stalled out in Congress all the way through the summer and into the fall. We saw a little bit of green shoots on it this week, some meetings between Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin and Nancy Pelosi. The administration has upped its offer, at least Mnuchin has upped his offer, to a package of $1.6 trillion, including $250 million in aid to state and local governments. But they're not there yet, and it's not clear the extent to which just because Steve Mnuchin is offering something, that means that the Trump administration is willing to do it and deliver it. There's really strong opposition from Republicans in the Senate to doing another relief package. So, Megan, what do you make of that? It feels like this is an obvious thing that would help the president's political fortunes. He has no real ideological objection to spending this money. How has he failed to do this one thing that's within his power that could help him get reelected?
Well, I mean, I think this goes back to what Jamel said, which is that the president didn't have an agenda. I disagree that he doesn't have kind of a set of policy prescriptions he would like to do. They don't map onto traditional ideological divisions, and he himself is certainly not ideological, nor does he have a kind of coherent, well thought out agenda. But there's a bunch of stuff he would have liked to have done, things like infrastructure. And they didn't happen. So why didn't they happen? Because he didn't have the political skills. He didn't actually have the ability to get congressional Republicans to do anything. And so his supporters are left bragging that he wrested a tax cut out of congressional Republicans, which is like the only thing they want to do. And I think what we're seeing here is that the GOP is if you ever doubted that they were sincere about the fiscal austerity stuff, they are. They really don't want to increase spending, even if it would help them politically. And I think that even for congressional Republicans, it would help them politically to have a stimulus right now. But they genuinely don't want to do it. And Trump does not have any kind of actual policymaking, political, legislative, coalition building skills that would enable him to get something through the Republican caucus that they don't want.
Michael, wasn't that supposed to be the point of Donald Trump, that he was going to wrest control of the Republican Party away from the establishment interest that controlled it toward a more populist direction? I mean, it seems like if he can't do this, what was the point of him being president?
That's the question we'll be asking after he's no longer president, right? What was his legacy if he campaigned one way and then governed another way? You know, he not only didn't have the skills, but there is a larger kind of environmental effect. You know, I've noticed in the past week, you know, in the past 2 weeks, Donald Trump was able to nominate and quickly get Senate Republicans to begin supporting a replacement for Ruth Bader Ginsburg on the Supreme Court. Why? Because there were existing institutions that were dedicated to doing this, that were committed to finding the talent and placing them in. On foreign policy, he predicted, or he wanted this kind of disruption and to pull troops out of Syria, out of Afghanistan, and found himself stymied. It took only until the last 3 or 4 weeks before he appointed a diplomat to Afghanistan who was committed to Trump's vision of pulling America's troops out of there, finally. And it took 3 years to do that because there aren't the existing institutions for that vision of foreign policy. And on populist economics or, you know, trade and immigration issues, again, there's a very limited talent pool. You know, a president comes in and a typical president ends up hiring 5,000 to 7,000 people to staff the executive branch and enact his vision. Trump has barely done that. I mean, hugely important figures in the executive branch are holdovers from previous administrations. They are third-rate administrators themselves, or the positions have been just unfilled. So that is one of the stories too, is that Donald Trump in many ways was a one-man band for this vision of politics, and that kind of preordained his failure to bring them about.
Let's take a break. I want to come back and talk about that Supreme Court nomination. I've been talking with Jamel Bowie of The New York Times, Michael Brennan Doherty of National Review, and Megan McArdle, columnist at The Washington Post. This is Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing from our left, right, and center, and we want to hear from you, too. Tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the free KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm Josh Barrow of New York Magazine. On the right is Michael Brendan Doherty, senior writer at National Review. On the left is Jamelle Bouie, columnist at the New York Times. And our special guest is Megan McArdle, columnist at the Washington Post. At Tuesday's debate, Trump and Biden discussed the nomination of Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court and what it might mean for the future of abortion rights and the Affordable Care Act. Biden said Roe v. Wade is on the ballot at the Supreme Court, and Trump objected to that, saying, quote, "You don't know her view on Roe," and saying that he doesn't think Roe is on the ballot. Michael, during the 2016 campaign, the president said he would appoint judges to overturn Roe. And yet we've heard talking points like this, not just from the president, but from a number of Republican senators saying that they don't think a court with Barrett on it would overturn Roe. And I guess I don't understand why they say that. Isn't a goal of the conservative legal movement to overturn the Roe decision?
I think it's a huge goal for a substantial portion of the Republican Party to use the legal conservative movement to do that. I think there are some real questions about whether Judge Kavanaugh, Roberts, maybe even Gorsuch would go that far, or whether they would stop short or use an incrementalist approach to just allow slightly more democratic regulation of abortion access at the state level rather than going at Roe in a sweeping way and allowing every kind of restriction. But it has been contradictory messaging, and you see Republicans struggling with it. I mean, Senator Josh Hawley said very recently that he would have an explicit commitment to overturning Roe as his litmus test. Judge Amy Coney Barrett is not going to give him that, is not going to say that out loud. And so he's had to find a way to say, well, looking at her legal views, he's satisfied. So this is still a problem of, when the court has played this enormous role in our politics, I think politicians struggle between their more moderate supporters and their more ideological supporters to explain how they're qualifying these justices to the court.
Megan, what do you make of that sort of hide the ball thing? Because polling on abortion is difficult. You ask questions different ways and you get all sorts of different answers. But one pretty consistent result is that people do not want to see the Roe decision overturned. And so this feels to me like a way to increase the likelihood of something happening while trying to avoid political accountability for it.
Well, I mean, I think there's two things, right? Is number one, yes, obviously, right? American abortion law is far to the left of what I think most voters want. I think if you look at polls, it's pretty clear that what most voters want is legal in the first trimester and illegal after that. On the other hand, I also think that most voters are not pro-life, and they actually like having a fair amount of deniability in gray area because they're not sure and they don't really want to have to make hard decisions about it. And ironically, that's what Roe has done, right? It has, by giving it to the court, prevented voters from having to decide firmly and clearly where they want to draw the line. And so I think that most voters would like that to continue. But at the same time, this is the voter intensity. It seems to be on the side of the Republicans in the court. We should remember that Roe is not the only thing that animated the conservative legal movement, but it's certainly one of the things. What conservative politicians have to overturning Roe in the same way that Democratic politicians have to pay fealty to the most maximalist possible interpretation of Roe in order to keep their interest groups happy. But at the same time, if you let a justice say it explicitly, you end up with after Bork, Republicans don't want to litigate the actual beliefs of their nominee because it's too poisonous. And they know that Democrats will take things out of context. They will, take sort of abstruse legal arguments about hypotheticals and turn them into and make them sound demonic. And so what they want is people who have no paper trail. And that is what the conservative legal movement has supplied. It's what the left also supplies it's really hilarious. Every 4 years or so, we have to listen to an eminent legal scholar being like, "Bro, did you say, was that Rice, Ram? I don't think I've heard of this decision," and pretending that they don't have a firmly fixed opinion, even though everyone who gets nominated to the court does.
Jamel, as Michael points out there, there's a lot of, this isn't a binary about whether Roe will be upheld or overturned. There's a lot of room for the court to allow more restrictions without officially overturning the decision. And so I'm wondering about the way that the Democrats message around that as they go into this to the hearings for this nominee.
You know, I don't actually think it requires that much messaging finesse, right? I mean, precisely because you have whatever President Trump may deny on the debate stage, it's pretty clear that he's promised to his supporters that he will nominate judges to overturn Roe. Democratic voters understand that the stakes of a Supreme Court fight are the future of abortion rights, among other things. I don't think there needs to be much messaging finessing if we're talking messaging. You just kind of straightforwardly say, President Trump says this is what he wants, and this is what's likely to happen, and this is going to we're taking our position because of this. I mean, part of what's interesting about the president's denial of wanting to overturn Roe or supporting judges that will overturn Roe at the debate is that it clearly demonstrates his awareness that this is just not something he wants to broadcast to the broad public, that given his personal weakness with college-educated women and even non-college-educated women, right, given his general weakness with women voters across the board, not to say that all women support Roe, but to say that this is a salient issue for a substantial number of American women, it's clear that he does not want the fight to be about this at all. And that his problem is that it's really not going to be that difficult to make this fight about this. It's why I think that the better political play for him might be just to delay confirmation after the election, just to delay everything until the lame duck. Even if that would enrage liberals, it would at least keep the Senate from debating these things live as people are casting ballots.
Yeah, I think there's been a weird miss in some of the political analysis around the Supreme Court and abortion in the election, which is to say that the president nominating a conservative figure to the court who is widely seen as a strong social conservative is a boon for him with certain parts of his base, and there are states where that is conceivably advantageous to him, particularly in the South. But the president's voting base in the North depends heavily on relatively secular, non-college white voters, a lot of whom are pro-choice. In states like Iowa and Wisconsin, the president, there's a key part of his coalition that favored him for reasons that were unrelated to these specific social issues that had to do with trade and immigration and various other things. And so, Michael, I'm wondering if you agree with that assessment from Jamel that this is maybe hurting Republicans politically, this fight over Barrett, that it's hurting him in parts of the North where he really needs to be shoring up support to get reelected.
It may be hurting him, yes. I mean, you're absolutely correct that one of the secrets to Donald Trump's success in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, was that he doesn't have a Southern evangelical affect about him. And that turns off a certain type of swing voter, often a kind of unchurched or alienated white ethnic Catholic who just doesn't like the style of the religious right and finds them moralizing and difficult. This nomination could present some problems, but again, I think that same type of voter may find it might be repulsed if Amy Coney Barrett is attacked based on her religious identity, even if that attack is coming from media outlets rather than Democratic senators. So I think there are dangers both ways, but I think Josh and Jamel, you're both right to highlight that there's this more secular element to Trump's populist independent voters that he needs so desperately.
The other big political risk for the president around this Supreme Court nomination seems to have to do with the Affordable Care Act, and that's where Democrats seem to be most focusing their messaging, at least the ones who are actually elected officials. As Michael notes, that you can't enforce message discipline across the entirety of Twitter, but what Democrats in office seem to be focusing on is the risk to the Affordable Care Act from a lawsuit that's currently making its way through the courts and that will be heard in the Supreme Court shortly after the election. So this lawsuit, this will be the third Supreme Court case about whether the ACA needs to be thrown out. And the theory here is that in 2012, we had this litigation about whether the individual mandate was constitutional. And Justice Roberts, Chief Justice Roberts, wrote this opinion saying it is constitutional because it's a tax. But then in 2017, the Republican tax bill reduced the individual mandate penalty to zero. And so the theory in this lawsuit is, well, if the penalty is $0, it's not a tax anymore. So it's not constitutional anymore. And so it needs to be thrown out. And if you throw out that piece of the law, you need to throw out the entire law. Now, this argument is a stretch, and it hasn't impressed a lot of legal scholars, whether they're conservative or liberal, but it did impress a trial judge who agreed with it and tried to throw out the entire law. Then there was an appellate court consideration of this lawsuit, and they upheld the judge's ruling saying the mandate was unconstitutional, but told him to go back and take a look. Maybe you don't need to throw out the whole law. Can you figure out which parts of the law need to be thrown out for this reason? But then the Supreme Court said it's going to take its own look, and that's when it's going to hear arguments after the election. Now, Megan, the talking point I keep hearing from Republicans here is that this lawsuit is very unlikely to succeed, that the legal theory is a real stretch, and we don't think the court's going to throw out the Affordable Care Act, whether Amy Coney Barrett is on the court or not. But Republicans are officially behind this lawsuit, including the Trump administration is supporting this lawsuit. The lawsuit is brought by Republican officials in Texas. So why isn't it fair for Democrats to say that Republicans are trying to get the Affordable Care Act thrown out, that would take health insurance away from about 20 million Americans, and that it's more likely that they'll succeed if you put more Republican judges on the courts?
This lawsuit is dopey, and I would lay like quite a lot of money that it is not going to succeed if I were allowed to bet on these things, which unfortunately I am not as a Washington Post columnist. We don't bet on outcomes we cover. That said, look, I mean, it's really interesting on one level, because in 2012, you had Democrats arguing that the mandate was absolutely essential to the law, and that if you took it away, like the entire House of Cards would collapse. That was an argument I believed. That was an argument everyone believed who was at all serious about analyzing healthcare. 8 years in, we actually know that this just doesn't seem to be the case. It turns out the subsidies matter a lot more than the mandate does, in part because the initial mandate was so weak that it just wasn't enough of an incentive for people to buy insurance. But we're going to see that reversed as this case goes into court. That said, look, I think it's unlikely to succeed just initially. I don't see why you can't have a tax that's zero, honestly. But second of all, if it does succeed, they're going to sever it. They're going to take away the mandate and leave the rest of the law intact, because we have discovered that it's actually just not that necessary to the functioning of the law. Third of all, Congress can fix it. Congress can go back in and say, you know, okay, but we still ban pre-existing conditions. And I think that that is what would happen, because pre-existing condition bans are really, 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 really popular. And I don't think that either at the state or the federal level, the government could resist the urge to keep that going. And so, I mean, it's not really a plausible possibility. That said, look, this is politics ain't beanbag. This is sort of reasonable political messaging that I would expect from Democrats. I think that left-wing commentators should, as a matter of fidelity to the truth, not repeat this ridiculous talking point and not pretend that it is at all likely. But I do think that it's totally fair for politicians to say it, because, you know, that's basically what you expect from them.
Jamil, what do you make of that?
I agree with Megan on the, if the court strikes down this provision, I don't see the court striking down this entire law. It would just be...
And so to explain to people what that would mean, basically, the mandate has already effectively been eliminated because it said it's $0. So the court could say, okay, the mandate is thrown out entirely. There isn't even a finger wag in the law saying you must buy health insurance. But because the rest of the law would stand, it wouldn't have any real practical effect.
Right. I think it's worth considering all of this in the context of sort of the broader court politics, right? Over the past couple weeks, there's been a push, a drive to get Democrats to commit to doing some sort of aggressive action towards the court, whether that's expanding the Supreme Court, whether it's expanding the entire federal judiciary, something. And I think that John Roberts, who is very much aware of, you know, the court's legitimacy, trying to shepherd the court's legitimacy, making sure the court is seen as much as possible a, you know, fair political actor, is not going to want to do anything that may push moderate or centrist Democrats into that direction. As long as moderates feel they have the ability to make policy without worrying too much about it being constrained by the judiciary, I think moderate Democrats are not going to want to do anything to, you know, they're not going to want to play any court constitutional hardball. But as soon as that is no longer the case, I think the calculation changes. And I have to assume that John Roberts is thinking about the same thing as pretty much anything comes up to his court.
Michael, the funny thing to me about the line of argumentation, both on this issue and on the abortion issue, is that it amounts to Republicans telling Democrats, like, you shouldn't freak out about this. You definitely shouldn't try to pack the court. You shouldn't try to stop us from filling this seat, because fundamentally the court is not as important as you think it is. The court, you know, even if the court consists of a large majority of our own appointees, they are not going to be so foolish as to agree with us in a lawsuit that we saw fit to file, because the lawsuit we filed was too stupid. And furthermore, that even though we get all these people on the court, we're not going to get our way on abortion jurisprudence in the way that we have been trying to for decades. And I guess the question is, if that's really true, and I suppose it could be true, then why did Republicans focus so hard on reshaping the judiciary? I mean, this has been job 1, 2, and 3 for Mitch McConnell. Isn't the revealed view of Republicans that the court really is important, that it does really make big differences in policy who you put on the courts, and that you really should care a lot?
Well, I mean, it does make big differences in policy. I mean, we just had the Bostock decision in the last term, which, you know, effectively dramatically expands the Civil Rights Act.
This is the decision that said that the sex discrimination provisions of the Title VII non-discrimination law, they extend to sexual orientation and gender identity in addition to sex.
Right. So, I mean, it does matter. I think this is a game, and I hate to be someone who's saying both sides, this is a game both sides do play, which is that you will have in an election year, I'm as a conservative and as a Catholic may say, hey, I really don't like the lawsuits that ACLU is launching against Catholic hospitals trying to get them to perform abortions. And you'll have Democrats say, those are ridiculous. Those are never going to be upheld at a Supreme Court level. You shouldn't worry about them. And yet I still worry about them. And I think that's the dynamic you're seeing with Republicans here as well, where a lot of elected Republicans don't mind that or are even willing to contribute to this idea of like whipping up people who still believe in repealing and replacing Obamacare, that this is an effort that's still ongoing, while out of the other side of their mouth saying, no, this isn't serious and you don't have to worry about it. I mean, it is the problem we identified earlier of trying to keep both, you know, an activist, ideologically committed core group of supporters in line while also appealing to a middle that is, you know, can be horrified by what they're actually intending to do. It's just a problem endemic to Democratic politics itself.
Let's take a break. I'll be back with Jamel Bouie of The New York Times, Michael Brendon-Doherty of National Review, and Megan McArdle of The Washington Post to talk about some of the more alarming moments from Tuesday's debate. This is Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from all sides. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and our companion show, All the President's Lawyers, at kcrw.com/podcasts or from the KCRW app.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Michael Brendon-Doherty, senior writer at National Review. On the left is Jamel Bouie, columnist at The New York Times. And our special guest is Megan McArdle, columnist at The Washington Post. So as the debate went on, I mean, it didn't really get any more frenetic because it was the president was frenetic from the very beginning. But there were a couple of moments that I think were a little bit shocking. And the first one had to do with the president receiving a question about white supremacists and the role that they are playing in the chaos that we're seeing in certain cities in the United States and in our politics, and would he condemn them? And then Biden specifically asked him if he would condemn this far-right group called the Proud Boys that has gotten into physical altercations in a number of cities with far-left groups like Antifa. The president, rather than condemning them, said that they should stand back and stand by. as these matters transpire. Now, after a few more attempts at this, a couple of days later, he told Sean Hannity of Fox News that he does, in fact, condemn the Proud Boys. But Michael, as we look at this unrest in cities, which obviously has come from a number of different sources, shouldn't the president be basically telling all of these troublemakers to knock it off, and he doesn't want them doing these things? And in a lot of these cases, it takes two to tango. And here we have the president providing what was certainly received by members of this group as encouragement for the activities that they're engaged in.
That's true. He should have been clearer, although I do think, I mean, I may be in an extreme minority in thinking that he was trying to do that during the debate, that his awkward stand back and stand by formulation was an attempt to repeat some language in Chris Wallace's question about standing down. And then he took a little bit from Biden's answer when he solicited, you know, who I should condemn, and picked up on the Proud Boys. It was clear, I think, he wanted to condemn them, say sure, when asked if he would condemn, and then repeating it days later. But he didn't find a way to do it convincingly. And it as you reminded me, Josh, it reminded other people of his reticence to condemn David Duke during the 2016 campaign, or to condemn other right-wing terror threats in his presidency. He hasn't earned the benefit of the doubt, and people didn't give it to him.
The way I took stand by, and it fit in with some stuff that he said about the election that we'll talk about in a moment, basically alleging that they are about to try to steal the election from him, and the way that certain conservatives have talked about Kyle Rittenhouse, that teenager who shot and killed two people during the chaos in Kenosha a few weeks ago, is basically there's this narrative that there's this chaos in the country, and law enforcement isn't necessarily going to save us from it, and that you need ordinary armed citizens to be standing by to interfere and to stop this. And so it was as though he was saying to the Proud Boys that he didn't want them to act yet, but he wanted them to be ready to. And I find that to be a disturbing message for a number of reasons, one of which is that even if people go into these situations with what they consider to be good intentions, I think putting a lot of angry and armed people out in the streets to yell at each other tends to lead to bad outcomes that a president should be trying to talk down instead of talking up. And so that's what I took away from it and why I found the comment to be alarming. Jamel, I was wondering what you made of it.
I mean, that's sort of what Michael was alluding to, that Trump generally has a hard time condemning white supremacists, is the thing that I found alarming about it. I mean, going back to, as Michael said, the David Duke comment, his sort of refusal to just outright condemn David Duke, the president just does not want to do it. If you want to take the most charitable interpretation of that, it might simply be that he resents being asked to do it. But the fact of the matter is that we know what it looks like when Trump wants to condemn something. And white supremacists, white nationalists, whatever you want to call them, don't come in for that treatment consistently. In the context of the debate, we can't really separate this particular exchange from an exchange later where he called on his supporters to act as, you know, quote-unquote poll watchers. I mean, take those two things together, and it does sound much more like direction than it does, you know, idle talk or, you know, misspeaking. And I think it's taking the totality of the president's statements with regards to white supremacists and white nationalists and these right wing groups and everything that makes it all very, very concerning.
Megan, a remarkable thing to me about this is often you associate populist movements with sort of extreme groups like this in the public, but this is not popular. Some of the president's lowest political moments have been when he's gotten caught up in this sort of stuff, including in the aftermath of Charlottesville. So it's hard for me to see, you know, why the president is not gaining political advantage by taking this line. So I think that's even more reason to think that he's sincere when he speaks as he does.
I don't know if sincere is the right word with Donald Trump. I'm not sure that he's sincere about anything except his own personal interests. You know, look, I think I agree with both Michael and Jamel that people misspeak. We all know that, right? We're all in public we speak a lot. We know that, like, I've sometimes said the exact opposite of what I was intending to say because you say the wrong word, you forget a negative. Or that said, all of his errors run in the same direction. And then that doesn't seem like an accident. The fact that he struggles with this and prefers, I think, to leave ambiguity about whether he supports white supremacists or not, that makes the white supremacists feel like he's one of theirs. I think that is deliberate. I don't think he's that dumb. And I think that, well, I don't think that there is some sort of Hitlerian strategy to disrupt the election. I think that he wouldn't be averse to that. If he loses the election, he would rather there be chaos and people in the streets supporting him than that he's just humiliated and has to leave office because it turns out no one really likes what he did.
So how much should we be worried about the aftermath of this election that we're about to have? And I wanted to talk about what the both of the candidates in the debate were asked about concerns about the integrity of the voting process. The president obviously has been on about this for months, saying that they're going to steal the election from him through the mail-in balloting and sort of Byzantine ideas about how people are going to like print counterfeit ballots overseas and somehow send them in, even though when your ballot arrives, there's an envelope that says who it's from, and so you can't have like a whole bunch of extra ballots not assigned to voters. And anyway, at the debate, Joe Biden basically looked straight into the camera and said, this is up to you as the voters. You vote and you determine the outcome of this election. The president was basically already declaring the election to be a fraud even before it's been conducted, even before he knows that he has lost it. You can think of that just as a psychological protection mechanism for him so that he doesn't have to admit that he's a loser. It can just be that he was the victim. There are concerns both about what that's going to lead to legally in the courts with state legislatures and, are there going to be competing slates of electors being sent to Washington with disputes over who won what states? And then also questions about civil unrest. So, Michael, do you worry about that?
Yeah, I do. I'll be honest. I thought Joe Biden helped himself by basically giving a message to the camera saying, trust the process. And then I think Donald Trump hurt himself by basically coming off like a loser. At the same time, I actually, and I hate to say this, I agreed with Donald Trump that the effacement of Election Day has a kind of danger to it. And there's a kind of what we saw in Florida in 2000 and what we've seen in other recounts is that when there are these huge multiple sources of votes or uncertain votes, that what in effect happens is that they all get counted in the media, and then lawyers fight about which piles should count electorally. And I do think that that is a real danger. I absolutely worry that there's going to be uncertainty in the week after the election. And I worry that there's going to be tens of thousands of people massing in the streets in Washington, D.C., waiting for some kind of precipitating event. I absolutely worry about this. And a good president would be urging calm no matter what. Like what Donald Trump said in that ugly answer about the Proud Boys was he said he wanted peace. But he said it almost as an aside. And in fact, that should be the main message.
Jamel, in terms of the potential of chaos around the election, I mean, there's a lot of states that conduct elections routinely by mail and have it down to a good system. And that can even be a system where it takes a while to count. In California, it takes like a week and a half to learn the results, which is annoying, but the state is organized about it and has experience. But there are also a lot of these states that don't really have experience doing it, that have been sending out way more ballots than they're used to and have been running into some trouble. In New York City, there are about 100,000 ballots, mostly in Brooklyn, that were sent out and people had return envelopes that belonged to someone else, often their neighbor. And so I think there is potential for some genuine election administration issues that will give people more space to argue about what the true result of the election is. And then when you add on that the fuel the president has poured on the fire, that does feel like something to worry about.
Yeah, I think your description there, I think, gets to an important point about all of this, which is that it is certainly the case that in a situation like the one we're in now, where there's this unprecedented expansion of just mail-in voting, regardless of the type, whether that's you have to request an absentee ballot, whether that's the state is sending out ballots directly, where just more people are voting by mail than ever before. And it's sort of inherent in that, that there's going to be more administrative problems, that there may be errors, but that this thing, this on its own isn't necessarily evidence that the election is going to be somehow compromised. That you can imagine a situation where every single stakeholder, from the people responsible from conducting elections to elected officials themselves, are behaving responsibly, are letting or saying, you know, this is, we may have these problems, but the elections are secure. We may have these problems, but everyone's vote is going to be counted, et cetera, et cetera. It is only because, this is my view, it's only because President Trump has been so vocally contemptuous of this process, only because he's spent the past, you know, several months insisting that mail-in balloting is going to be fraudulent, that there's going to be mass voter fraud, that you cannot trust the results. It's only because of this kind of rhetoric that any of this is potentially, you know, a serious problem next month, that to the extent that we have, you know, disruption on the ground, that we have, you know, confrontations at, you know, polling places, at, you know, election offices. I think it really has to do with the fact that the president's been stoking it. And if he had not been stoking it, then I don't think it'd be nearly the same kind of problem. Obviously, you know, because the stakes are so high, it's a presidential election, there's going to be, you know, legal maneuvering and, you know, people contending to try to get the strongest advantage they can. But the kind of dread people are feeling about what may happen if we don't immediately get a decisive result on election night, that's a product of the president, I'm afraid.
We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Michael Brendan Doherty, what's your rant?
Well, because I'm recording this from my own office in the suburbs, I think it's appropriate for me to say that I support every and any attempt by any locality to ban the use of two-stroke engine leaf blowers. These are a menace to all society, not just the recording of a podcast like this one. They actually do put out fumes that are harmful to the often immigrant workforces that are using them, employed to use them. And there are now good enough battery-powered options that are both much quieter and don't have these fume problems. It's time for localities to make this social revolution happen now.
Jamel Bowie, it's your soapbox.
I hate the term virtue signaling so much. I understand that it represents something of a real phenomena. People who do the virtuous thing and preen about it in order to get, you know, social approval. But I actually don't think that's very common. And I think the term has come to just encompass everyone acting socially in a way that, you know, it's they believe to be, you know, socially responsible. They should want to broadcast that they are doing the right thing. I think this is healthy for society. I think we do not want a society where people feel the reverse. And so the extent to which, you know, doing that becomes an insult, that you're, you know, you're just virtue signaling, you don't really mean it, I just think it's corrosive and bad, because what you truly do not want is vice signaling, right? You don't want people to broadcast how they're terrible. That is, you know, deleterious to social cohesion. So that's my rant. Don't like that term. Wish people would stop using it.
Megan McArdle, what's on your mind?
I had my annual mammogram this morning, and I just want to say it was quick and professional. They took my temperature as I went in. They asked me a series of screening questions. They had everything marked out on the floor. I went through the process, and I got what was for me a vital health service, because I have a family history of breast cancer. And I would just like to say a lot of people have stopped going to get these screenings. It's not just breast cancer. Pap smears save so many women's lives every year. Colon cancer screenings, prostate, more dubious, but if you have a family history, you should be getting them. My 75-year-old mother, who has COPD, she was in the ICU with pneumonia last Christmas. She goes for her checkups. If she can slap on a mask and brave the doctor's office, you can too, healthy middle-aged person. This is so important. It is so important that if you are having the signs of a heart attack or a stroke, that you get to the ER and don't worry that maybe you'll catch COVID there. Health facilities are very good at managing the safety procedures. They're better than almost anyone else. And if you are having a health problem, you need to go get that checked up, get your regular screenings, get your regular doctor's visits, rather than risking a much more serious health complication because you're afraid of catching COVID, which is very unlikely.
For my rant, the New York Times obtained nearly two decades of tax records related to President Trump and his businesses. And the headline is that in most of the years from 2001 to 2017, the president paid no federal income tax. In 2016 and 2017, he paid just $750 each year. Now, a lot of liberals jumped on this to say, see, Trump is a bad businessman. He's broke. He paid no taxes because he reported no net income. His golf course in Miami alone lost $160 million, according to his taxes. But this is not the right takeaway. If you are presented with Donald Trump's tax information, you should take it seriously, but not literally. Donald Trump is obviously rich. Broke people do not have private 757s. You can tell from his lifestyle and from his expenses that he has lots of income available to him. The money is coming from somewhere. If it's not showing up on his tax returns as taxable income, maybe that's because he's found very clever ways to tinker with his finances for tax purposes. Or maybe it's simply because he's breaking the tax laws. We don't know. It is fairly likely that the Manhattan District Attorney is looking into that. But either way, whether his tax planning strategies are on the level or not, he is rich. And he's not paying as much income tax as the law ought to require him to. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Jamel Bowie, Michael Brendan Doherty, and Megan McArdle. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Our production fellow is Victoria Alejandro. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.
From PRX.